I'm Jean Lee.
And I'm Jeff White.
And we're back with a brand new episode of our podcast, The Lazarus Heist, recorded in front of a live audience in New York City.
That's our new special live episode of The Lazarus Heist, the podcast about hacking and North Korea.
And we're returning soon with a second season.
So what better moment to listen to the whole of season one? Or, if you've heard it already, listen again. Remind yourself of the whole story.
For the new episode and for the whole of the first season, search for The Lazarus Heist wherever you found this podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Witness History podcast from the BBC World Service. It's 60 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis brought the world to the brink of nuclear war. In this programme, first broadcast in 2012, Joe Fidgen spoke to an American intelligence officer who played a crucial role as the crisis unfolded.
It's the 15th of October 1962, and Dino Brigioni, a CIA imagery expert, is scrutinising photos taken by US spy planes over Cuba.
We saw Russian tents. They were alien. You wouldn't expect to see 100-foot tents or 65-foot vehicles on a farm. So that immediately caught our attention. Then we started measuring the objects, and they came out to be the SS-4 medium-range ballistic missile that we had seen paraded in the streets of Moscow.
While you were looking at these photos, were you conscious of the enormous implications of them?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The photographs meant a crisis.
The next morning, Dino's boss, Arthur Lundahl, presented the photographs to President John F. Kennedy. The meeting was recorded.
The other encampment contains vehicles and tents, but with no missile trailers.
How do you know this is a medium-range ballistic missile?
The length, sir.
The what?
The length of it, yes.
The length of the missile, which part? Which part?
The president turned to Mr. Lundahl and said, "Are you sure?" And Mr. Lundahl said, "Mr. President, I'm as sure of this as we can be sure of anything."
The president ordered the number of surveillance flights over Cuba to be increased. On one day alone, the exposed film was 25 miles long. Dino Brigioni's job was to produce regular briefings for President Kennedy.
The president was always very gracious and very helpful. Let me tell you a little story. There was always a little girl who was chafing at the bit to come in to see her daddy. So after the briefings were concluded, the nanny would turn Caroline loose, and she would come run in, and she would jump in the president's lap. She just loved being with the president. But then there were briefing boards left on the table, and when they came back, they were all colored up with a blue crayon. So we put them together in a booklet, and we called it Caroline Kennedy's Blue Coloring Book. But that was a time from 5 o'clock until dinner. That was a time with the president had with his daughter. But at the same time, he'd get the latest information on what was happening in Cuba.
On the 22nd of October, the president went public.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
The scene was set for a showdown. An emergency session of the United Nations Security Council was called for the 25th of October. America's ambassador to the UN, Adlai Stevenson, armed with information provided by Dino Brigioni, confronted the Russian ambassador, Valerian Zorin.
All right, sir. Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
I am not in an American courtroom, sir, and therefore I do not wish to answer a question that is put to me in the fashion in which a prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
World opinion right now, and you can answer yes or no. You have denied that they exist. I want to know if I've understood you correctly.
I should like to say,
sir, would you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
I later met Stevenson, and he claimed that he wasn't very diplomatic with Zorin, but I thought that was his crowning achievement. It was backing Zorin into a corner and kind of beating him up a little bit. But he did that with the very briefing boards that I had prepared. Not only my photograph, but my notes. He was reading from my notes.
Despite the mounting pressure at work, Dino couldn't talk to his wife about it.
Well, she was a good trooper. She never did ask what I was doing because it was highly classified what I was doing. I had 12 security clearances at the time. Oh, no, you couldn't talk about anything. We talk about the kids. We talk about what we're going to do in the weekends and things like that. I learned and she learned. She learned not to ask me and I learned not to tell her.
Every day, fresh reels of film arriving at the CIA showed that work on assembling the Soviet missiles was continuing apace. Then came the photographs the Western world had been dreading.
When I got afraid was Black Saturday, October the 27th. That morning, we briefed Mr. Lundahl that all 24 pads at six sites were operational, meaning that within 4 to 6 hours, there could be 24 missiles coming at the United States. I prepared the briefing for the president that night, and when my boss got back, I said, how did it go? And he said, not good at all. The president's very concerned. That night, I was convinced that we were going to be at war. We were at DEFCON 2 at the time. DEFCON 2 is extreme preparedness for war. DEFCON 1 is war.
There was talk of President Kennedy going to an underground shelter, and Dino was expecting to go with him to prepare the briefings, leaving his family exposed to nuclear attack in Washington.
I called my wife that night, and I said, if I call you again, put the kids in the car and start up in Missouri, where my parents lived. I'd given her an envelope, and I said, don't open that envelope unless I call you and tell you to.
Do you remember exactly what you wrote in that letter to your wife?
Well, yes, but that's secret.
Did your wife ever get to read it?
No, she didn't, because I told her to tear it up when I retired. And she did.
By October the 27th, the tension had reached such a height that the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, felt he had to step back from the brink and avoid nuclear war. He swiftly announced the missiles on Cuba would be withdrawn. But President Kennedy warned that U.S. surveillance of the island would continue.
This government has no choice but to pursue its own means of checking on military activities in Cuba. The importance of our continued vigilance is underlined by our identification in recent days of a number of Soviet ground combat units in Cuba.
So the crisis wasn't yet over for Dino and his colleagues.
We were flying missions all over Cuba checking, and we didn't see any indication that they were removing the launchers from the pads. But the next morning, Monday, we saw that they were. Then it became a big job of counting and making sure that all the missiles left Cuba. And there were 20. And we watched them deliver them to the port, and we watched them putting on ships. And then we tracked them all the way back to the Caspian Sea and the Baltic Sea to make sure that they had gone back to Russia rather than maybe one of the satellite countries. And that was a big sigh of relief on my part and others, that the crisis basically had ended.
Their work earned them a personal commendation from President Kennedy.
Oh, yes, yes, that's one of the highlights of my career. I felt good at what we had done. All the work that we had put in had paid off. We had kept the country from possibly a nuclear holocaust. I reflected on it afterwards. My grandfather came to the United States from Italy without the proverbial pot. And he was a coal miner, and he brought my dad over, and my dad worked in the coal mines with him. And so here it was, a coal miner's son was preparing the information for the president. And only in America could that happen.
Dino Brigioni died in 2015. He was speaking to Joe Fidgen for that edition of Witness History, first broadcast in 2012. If you'd like to hear more, you'll find a collection of programmes about Cuba at bbcworldservice.com/witnesshistory.
What's it like working as an outsider, as an American, inside arguably the most secretive country in the world? North Korea.
And how do you go about tracking hackers in real time, even reading their messages?
I'm Jean Lee. I opened the first and only U.S. news bureau in North Korea.
And I'm Jeff White, an investigative journalist covering tech and organized crime.
And we're back with a brand new episode of our podcast, The Lazarus Heist, recorded in front of a live audience in New York City.
We're joined on stage by a North Korean defector and a cybersecurity expert who tracks hackers.
And there's even some advice about trying to keep yourself safe from hackers online.
That's our new special live episode of The Lazarus Heist, the podcast about hacking and North Korea. The Lazarus Heist live show, it's available now.
And we're excited to tell you we're returning soon with a second season of The Lazarus Heist.
So if you haven't done so already, what better moment to listen to the whole of season one? Or if you've heard it already, listen again. Remind yourself of the story.
For the new episode, and for the whole of the first season, search for The Lazarus Heist wherever you found this podcast.